into thin air. From The Gods Have Horns by Saltiside and Shadow Wasserson, read by Sam Gabriel, based upon the works of Andrew Hussey. One. Without Control. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and you are about to break your employment contract. At the beginning of your career, you signed a document that all system admins at Skya Corp do, forbidding you from praying to any god or goddess who did not hold shares in Skya Corp. That meant the mage, the maid, the seer, the prince, and the witch were cleared for prayer, and the others were not. You, however, have decided to pray to the Sylph. You need to talk to her about fast-forwarding the timeline for humanity's interplanetary travel, specifically whether you could get functional, self-sustaining colonies in other star systems sometime in the next few years. The punishment for breaking this contract is termination, and you are 98% sure that this does not only mean termination of employment. You've always been on good terms with the gods, but you still know you may be putting your life on the line. But so many other lives are on the line as well, you would have to be unbelievably evil not to do it. You're shaking. You kneel down and open your mouth to speak the words of the prayer, but before you can pronounce a single syllable, a goddess appears. It's not the Sylph, it's the seer, her face split by a sharp smile. Your heart skips a beat, and you make a strangled sound, but she waves her hand airily.
Take a seat, I'm not here to kill you.
But... your voice is strained.
You haven't done anything yet. And mere intent is not in itself a crime, usually. And I'm not going to execute you for your data excavation escapade either.
You swallow. She knows about that already. It was only a few hours ago that you'd hacked the corporate server, digging in as deep as you could go, drilling past one firewall after another, unraveling encryption after encryption. You'd found that the endgame for Skya Corp as a company is to create a virtual reality program that has an effect in real, living reality, that blends the two until they are indistinguishable, and eventually empowers its users to create an entirely new universe and rule it as gods. The only casualty would be the Earth itself. You're so afraid that you feel sick from it, and along with that, you're shaking with rage. The company you've worked at for 5 years is engineering the apocalypse, and you've been bamboozled by the living gods themselves to help it along. You want to throw your computer monitor at the seer, or throw a broken bottle at her, or maybe just throw up. The seer's smile is opaque.
So, you know about the game. That's inconvenient.
Inconvenient? You can't believe it. You were going to do an acrobatic fucking pirouette off the handle. You were going to let her have it.
How could you do this to us? You shout. To the entire world! You're angry,
the seer observes, nodding and still infuriatingly smiling.
Understandable, given the circumstances. I'm going to save us some time by issuing an abstract of this conversation. You are going to call me insane, cruel, terrible, plenty of unkind things, she says, counting them off on her fingers. You will also express despair and horror that your planet will be destroyed. You will tell me that I should be ashamed, that I should apologize for involving you in such a vicious, evil project, etc., etc.
You clench your fists and consider striking the seer, but the goddess holds up a finger.
You have not yet committed a capital crime, but be careful lest I find you in contempt of court, she says,
and you remain still.
If I allow your rant to continue, your volume will build and you will talk until your voice becomes hoarse. You will probably cry. In conclusion, it's nothing that I haven't heard before.
You can't bear this, even with her threats looming over your head. You open your mouth, but she interrupts.
Feel free to say everything you were going to, or just call me juvenile names if you prefer. I won't stop you. But you will hear me out. First, she says,
there is no room for argument. Then the seer explains. There's no point trying to stop the game. It's already happened. Your own existence is proof of that, and your divine origins fell from the sky on a meteor. If you stopped now, you'd create a paradox, and what then?
How long do we have?
You ask, finally, voice ragged.
Salix projects that the game will be completed in 16 years, Aradius says that between an unusually sticky bug in the code and a freak hurricane that disrupts a critical part of the supply infrastructure, it'll be complete in 17 years and 4 months.
17 years.
What if I quit? The seer tilts her head. You are entwined with this project and integral to its success. The only way to extricate yourself from this scenario would be to die. Even so, that will only create a doomed timeline. Since you like computers, imagine our timeline, including our future, everything from the beginning of this universe to the completion of the game as a program. If something goes wrong, like your absence from the project, then the program crashes, restarts from the last viable saved state, and tries again.
Your shoulders drop.
So, all of humanity? All on Earth, anyway, yes. The seer pauses. The last time that the game was played, the results were apocalyptic. Only a handful of people survived, but there were unusual factors involved in that case. If we moved some humans off-world, then they would survive. However, she continues before you can speak up, you must not speak of this to the Sylph. Transplanting your entire species is untenable. Suffice it to say, there are reasons we have forbidden off-world colonies to humans until you have developed interstellar travel for yourselves. But she will not see it that way. Unlike the creation of the game itself, the fate of humanity is not written in stone. But if you don't trust us on this, if you so much as insinuate the Sylph, then rather than saving some of your people, you will lose all of them.
Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and you're hungover. You are hungover because you drank last night. You can't believe it. 9 years sober, 9 years. You wrecked it, you awful excuse for a functional human being. 9 years you were sober. Why would you... Oh, right. Now you remember why. The world is ending in 17 years and change, and you're helping it end. You close your eyes against the light and groan. God, this hangover sucks. Well, you're still here, not dead, so this is the choice you made. Your eyelids are not enough of a shield against the bright sunlight streaming through the windows of your home. You put a hand over your eyes, still not enough. You turn your head into whatever furniture you happen to be laying on and moan miserably into the sticky upholstery. A scream would be more apropos, but any loud sound is too much right now. You need to get up. You have responsibilities. You need to feed the cat. Your forehead is making a crinkling noise. With great reluctance, you reach up and remove the piece of paper taped to your forehead. Whose idea was that? Well, it's written in code, so it's probably yours. At least that gives you something to think about other than the end of the world, your headache, and your overall grossness. The code isn't too hard to break, but now it somehow makes even less sense. Saggy has the answers you want. Well, that's dumb. Who or what the hell is a Saggy? Dumb, stupid, stupid. Your name is Roxy Lalonde. You feel like absolute shit, and this stupid note isn't helping. Well, you'll think about it another time. For now, the world is going to end, and you feel like a drink. You pour yourself one.
Two.
Without choice. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and in no way are you cut out to be a mother. The very notion is ridiculous. It's laughable. Ha ha. No, you're a mess. In the past year, your life has gone quite rapidly down the shitter. You can barely hold it together at work, and now this? You look down miserably at the little baby in your arms, your daughter, legally and, according to the lab, genetically as well. She coos. Fuck, why do babies feel the need to be so cute? You try to give the baby to someone else. You're pretty sure that Finders Keepers doesn't apply to magic god babies that fall out of the sky, nor to the state's foster care system. But no, apparently the gods have ordained that you raise this helpless infant. Even now, the social services worker, who has broken into a cold sweat, is explaining about how some convoluted law signed decades ago makes it so that if a child is of possibly divine or otherworldly origin, they fall under jurisdiction of certain NGOs, which of course answer to their boards of officers, which in turn are mostly staffed by ranked angels and higher-ups at Skya Corp. And they placed her with you. You leave in a huff. This is so unfair, not just to you, but to this nominally innocent baby girl, pink-eyed and guileless, with chubby pink baby cheeks and blonde baby curls, this sky-spawned, cute little snot-nosed, wiggler kid. While you make your way miserably back to your car, balancing the baby and thinking about the cost of infant formula, your cell phone beeps. Twin Armageddon's TA has begun trolling Tipsy Nostalgic TG.
TG.
What do you want?
TA.
I see you tried to get rid of her again.
TA.
It's starting to get annoying.
TG.
I can't believe you think I can raise the baby.
TG.
I can barely raise myself.
TA.
Are you drunk again?
TG.
No, I'm texting with left hand.
TG.
Baby another.
TA.
That's sweet. What are you gonna name her?
TG.
You can't do this to me, I'll get a lawyer.
TA.
Mine's better.
You're too distraught to text back for several minutes, then...
TA.
I give you promotion.
TG.
What?
TA.
Keep the kid, and I'll give you promotion.
TG.
Fuck you, that's not fair.
TA.
What price will be fair to you?
TG.
I can't be bought.
TA.
Yes, you can. What price?
TG.
It's not fair to the kid. I'm not fair for her.
TA.
Then stop the drinking. Simple solution, Lalonde.
TA.
At least until you can put her in the boarding kindergarten.
TG.
Stop drinking. You say that like it's simple.
TA.
Well, your spelling has improved in the last few texts, so something must be sinking in.
TG.
I put her down, asshole. I'm in the car.
TG.
Anyway, boarding school is expensive.
TA.
So you're saying that...
TA.
You need a raise?
TG.
Fuck you.
Tipsy Nostalgic has blocked Twin Armageddon's. That'll hold him a few seconds. You look over at the baby who has fallen asleep. Give up drinking, you feel a cold wash of relief, followed immediately by a weird dread. You'll lose something if you stop drinking. You know you will, but you don't know what. Your cell phone beeps again.
Twin Armageddon's has sent an attachment. The baby name wizard. A magical method for finding the perfect name for your baby.
Damn it. You're going to need to buy a lot of diapers. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and your new home is real swank, huge, spare, and stylish in all the right ways. There's plenty of cupboards to hold booze, which is both delightful and most unhelpful, a gigantic foyer, just in case you get any visitors from work, and a secret lab in the basement for personal projects. You feel precisely zero regret for buying it on the company dollar. After all, in 16 years, it won't matter in the least. Speaking of, the baby is crying. You take a sip of wine. No, not the baby, Rose. Rose is crying, right? You go to Rose's room, lavishly cushioned and pink, and make reassuring sounds at the baby.
Don't cry, don't cry, you coo to her.
You set your wine glass down on the windowsill and pick her up.
Nothing to cry about. It's all just our collective fates. Yes, Rosie. There, there.
The wailing tot calms eventually and falls asleep in your arms. She's damn cute. You imagine her growing up, learning to talk and read and write and do differential calculus, maybe. Your stomach ties into a knot. You'll have to teach her how to code before she hits puberty, or she won't be any good at it by the time the world ends and she turns into a god. Maybe. You look at your sleeping daughter. Neither of you asked for this, but there it is. You can't do this. You have to do this. You take a deep breath and gently lay Rose down in her crib. One day after the next, just keep walking forward. 16 years of living death, and then it'll be over. You pick your wine glass up again and drink deep. You need to get your mind off of this. Assured that Rose is sleeping well for now, you go back to your own room and open your note drawer. Quite a few notes have built up by now, all encoded, all nonsensical, all in your own handwriting. Broken arrows. Use titanium shaft, lol. Won't talk about the horn, broken one. Why? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Lol doesn't know, like, swears. Fiddlesticks you too, mister. Saggy equals saddy. Rofflomeo. Can't tap dat robot. Lol. Said robot don't have, and this is I'm gonna puke. Four. There are four most useful thing he said. Lol, I'ma need some new tolls. Yeah, you don't know what to do with these. They feel important, but you don't have a fucking clue what they are supposed to mean. They're an enigma wrapped in a mystery, but at least they'll engage your tipsy brain until you black out. That's the best you can ask for these days. 3. Without awareness. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and you are a single working mother of a precocious little 4-year-old daughter. You work from home mostly, and can afford childcare services for when you need to be at the office. Today Rose is going away to preschool for the first time. You escort her to the bus, pat her gently on the top of her little head, and away she goes. You go to the car and drive back the way to the house. You don't mind walking the distance, but you're not wearing heels, but you think it might be a bit far for Rose. The mansion seems awfully quiet without Rose in it. Still, you are both a workaholic and an alcoholic, and your country estate is very nearly bucolic. You have no shortage of things to do. You check your email. You have a message from Twin Armageddon's, but do not feel fear or dread at encountering the handle. It's not at all out of the ordinary to get company mail from the CEO. The contents of the message are, however, personalized and somewhat cryptic. There's someone you should meet. Contact this number ASAP. Followed by a phone number, odd. Well, you are in no rush to please the god, CEO or not. By now you are aware that, despite your lack of choice as to the role of your own destiny, you can still rebuke the gods in other more subtle ways. Procrastinating getting in touch with whoever this is one way to do so. After all, the gods can only punish you so much before it starts to interfere with their plans. You feed the cat, you mix yourself a martini, you scan your newsfeed, mostly bad, which is normal. You go down to the lab to check the latest readings, mostly normal, which is bad. You do some calculations and refinement of the data, and then you mix yourself another martini. The house is very quiet. No television, no shrieks of joy or displeasure, no Rose's piping voice reading aloud to herself or to Jasper's. You mix yourself a martini. You should probably call that number before you get too tipsy.
Hello?
The voice on the other line sounds male.
Stanley speaking. Who is this?
Roxy Lalonde of Skya Corp Labs, pleased to speak with you, you reply, putting on your most chipper tone. You pause and wait for him to recognize your name, but instead he responds,
I'm sorry, but I'm not interested in anything you're selling.
The smile you'd plastered on falters. Well, I'm not selling anything, Stanley. I'm calling because a certain acquaintance of mine suggested we should talk. Silence. A certain divine acquaintance? Is any of this ringing a bell? More silence, then a slight rustling noise, the sound of a door shutting in the background. Then, in a faint, near whisper.
Is this about John?
Sorry?
No.
His voice sounds ragged, desperate. Entirely different than when he picked up the phone.
This is his first day of preschool. Please, please, is he... Did they find him?
You frown. I'm afraid I don't know what you're talking about.
My son.
Ah. This, at least, is something you can connect with. You know, it's my daughter's first day at preschool, too. It feels strange, doesn't it, letting them off into the world like that? I didn't expect it, but I'm feeling rather adrift without her, you confide. Still more silence, so you continue. I'm sure your son is doing fine.
Did they tell you to say that?
His words are harsh. Stanley,
you say kindly. I haven't the faintest god's damn clue what you're talking about, so I'll stop mincing words. My boss is the Mage of Doom. May his eyes burn forever, and he told me to call you without explaining who you were, or what I should say, or why, okay? You gotta throw me a bone here.
The Mage,
Stanley says, and lets out a long, long breath. Then,
he's the one who told me about John years ago.
Great, tell me about that. You talk about John for a while, his strange origins and Stanley's hopes for his future. You assure Stanley that John will be all right in preschool. Then you talk about Rose. You say rather a bit less about her origins, but freely brag about her cleverness, her huge vocabulary, her above-grade level reading. The two of you commiserate about being single working parents. Of course, you pick up right away what is going on, that his son is like your daughter, but keep your cards close to your chest about the apocalypse. You have a feeling that telling him won't end well. Then, shit, it's time to pick up Rose from the bus stop. You bid Stanley, who seems to be in a different time zone, a hasty farewell. In the car, Rose chatters nonstop about preschool, and you smile and nod, shelving away mentions of ponies and music lessons for future extracurricular options. You save Stanley's number in your phone. It might come in handy later. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and for the first time in a long while, you have a friend.
So that's the note I left under the television.
Stan finishes his story, sounding proud. That's a good parenting strategy, you reply, smiling into the phone. I'll have to think of something fun like that for Rose.
It's not only for fun,
Stan objects.
It's also to mark the milestone as he grows up.
You make a non-committal sound into the phone. Your thoughts about Rose growing up are complex. Hold on, I've got to show you something. Rose is psychoanalyzing Jaspers in the next room, and it's cute as all get out. You mute the phone, sneak up to the doorway, and try to poke the camera lens around the corner for a clandestine, candid photo. Unfortunately, your efforts are to no avail. Your first grader yelps, hurriedly trying to conceal her notepad.
Mom, this is a confidential psychiatric session! You can't see!
Jasper simply looks at you and blinks slowly, unfazed. Okay, alrighty. Sorry, Dr. Rosie, you say, inclining your head, not sorry at all. Not even to put in a holiday card, huh? Rose pouts. She's just so damn cute.
No! You're undermining the patient-doctor relationship!
Okay, hon, okay. I'll leave you be. You close the door and look back at the phone. You have a lovely picture of Rose flailing and shouting at you. It'll have to do. You send the picture to Stan, then unmute yourself.
Isn't she precious? She says the cat suffers from a Napoleon complex. I didn't even know they taught about Napoleon in first grade, lol.
Stan chuckles, the sound rich and deep. You like it when he laughs.
She's quite talented. And grown a lot, it looks like, since the last picture.
No kidding. She's gonna eat me out of house and home at this rate. That last is not true. You have more than enough house and home for Rose's appetite. You pause. Over the course of your friendship, you've learned that Stan always appreciates questions asked of him to be straightforward.
Why don't you ever send any pictures of John?
Silence, and you can hear Stan breathing. You wait.
I still have a hard time giving identifying information about him to someone who works for the gods. You understand?
You nod, though he can't see it.
Sure, but I work for the Mage, and he already knows about you and John.
I don't exactly talk to a lot of other gods on the regular. You pause again. Look, he introduced us, and that's not a coincidence. He clearly wants me to help you, or you to help me in our respective roles. Just because we don't know exactly how isn't a reason not to engage with this stuff.
I'm not interested in playing a god's game.
Stan's tone is firm. Oh, Stan. If only he knew. You want to tell him very badly, but even if John is like Rose, Stan is not like you. He's not necessary to the gods' plans, and that makes him expendable. You don't even know the real extent of how bad it could get if you learned about the apocalypse at this stage. I know it's not a game, I understand. You don't have to do anything you're uncomfortable with, but I do value our friendship. I hope that doesn't count as a god's game for you.
he says after a moment.
It doesn't. I value our friendship as well.
Sure, you smile. Maybe one day you'll even send me a picture of yourself. I bet you're real handsome. He coughs and sputters. Your smile grows wider. You like having that effect on him. When he hangs up, you notice a faint smell of smoke and your heart nearly stops. Rose. Thankfully, it's just Rose trying to burn Jasper's psychiatry notes on the stovetop in the kitchen, and nothing important is on fire. You scold her for using the stove without asking permission and have her help you clean up the scraps of paper. As you do, you can't help but glance at what's written on the still legible ones. How odd. All they say is meow. Your name's Roxy Lalonde and it's late. You swish your martini in its glass, then speak into the phone. Maybe one day we'll meet in person, somewhere in the middle of the country, equally far from both of us, in some ratty motel where no one suspects a thing.
Roxy.
He sounds taken aback by your forwardness. Nah, you're right. I don't do ratty. You can wine and dine on a cruise ship with fireworks going off in the background like proper grown-ups.
Roxy, you're an exceptionally lovely woman, truly, but I can't take so much time off work, and I'd have to get a sitter for John.
You sigh. You dated boys when you were younger, but your whole adult life, you've never gone steady with a man. But this single dad in Washington, he makes you blush like a schoolgirl, and you've still never seen his face. You allow yourself the fantasy and forget for a little while to worry about the future. 9 years.
So I don't think a trip makes sense right now.
Well, you consider. I could come visit you. Rose will be in school.
I don't... What about your work?
They can live without me for a weekend. Simon's on the other end. You close your eyes. You're still worried about the gods. Deep breath. Stan, I'm not asking you as an agent of divinity or anything. I'm asking you as a friend and as a confidant and as someone who would like to be more than that.
Roxy, you don't even know what I look like.
He sounds uncertain. Doesn't he believe your words? There's a pause. Then you hear your voice chat app chime. He comes on screen and you smile. He doesn't look like how you expected, but you don't mind. When he smiles back at you, that's all that matters. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and you are completely sloshed tonight. You're holding a mop because Rose is asleep, and you're going to clean your immaculate floors, properly housewife style, despite that you're no one's housewife and probably never will be. 8 years, after all, you say to the mop in a sing-song tone. The mop can't hear you. It's a mop, and the past doesn't predict the future, but the gods sure do. So you brandish your cleaning implement at the floor a bit, then realize that you forgot the bucket of soap and water. Oopsie. You realize your phone is ringing. You can hear it. How long has it been ringing? You're not sure. You go to look for it, lightheaded, swaying a little as you walk. Where is it? It stopped ringing. Fuck. By the time you find it, it has a text message from Stan. Fuck, Stan called. It's probably for the best you didn't pick it up, but he doesn't like it when you're like this. But you want to talk to him. You decide to call him back. But first you read the message. He told me he was too old to sleep in onesies, but he's wearing the dinosaur pajamas you sent. I think he likes them after all. There's a picture. John, 8 years old today, standing in his room with a gap-toothed grin, displaying his birthday haul, a bunch of robot toys, a few magic treehouse books, and wearing the T-Rex onesie you sent him. Kids going through a dinosaur phase, you see. You start to smile, but what catches your eye next strangles your happiness in its crib. The clowns are everywhere, scrawled in indigo paint, fanged, vicious, purple clowns on the walls, the windows, the hardwood floor of John's room, towering, looming over John's bed like horrible painted giants. And arrows, in purple likewise, pointing directly to where the boy would lay while asleep. Well, that's ever so slightly sobering. You text Stan. Oh, what's with the clowns? A few moments pass before... You're drunk, Roxy. You should go to bed. It's enough I can't have seen all those clowns. You really shouldn't drink so much. It's very bad for your health. You don't talk. You smoke. Please, go to sleep. You're not yourself when you're this drunk. You're not even seeing straight. I sent you a picture of John, not a clown. I mean the clowns on his wall. I'm a guy. They're creepy as fuck. What clowns? Purple clowns. John is the pig. I'm not crazy.
Didn't say you were crazy. Please go to bed. We can talk in the morning, when you're feeling better.
You continue to text him, describing the clown drawings in some detail, but he stops responding. Eventually, you pass out on the couch. 4. Without reason. Your name is Roxy Lalonde, and you're used to waking up to drunk texts. Meaningless encoded notes and scribbles, rows cuddled up to you, puddles of vomit, and combinations of any and all of the above. Sometimes you wake up to your skull feeling like it's going to crack open, or to half-forgotten dreams of impenetrable darkness. Once or twice you've woken to weird bruises on your hands that you can't recall the origins of. Something is amiss, but you don't have time to think over it right now. Rose, already dressed, is hollering from the hallway that she's going to be late for school, and you need to make yourself presentable.
Rose, sweetie, Mom has a hangover.
You groan, but school is school, and missed buses are missed buses, so you splash some water on your face, force down a bit of toast and coffee, and drive your daughter to class. After the whirlwind of rushing about, preparing for the day, you revisit the texts, frowning and squinting at the picture. John, smiling, wearing an adorable dinosaur onesie, surrounded by birthday presents. Not a clown in sight. You've never known yourself to straight up hallucinate while drunk, certainly not to hallucinate purple clowns. That's definitely new. You type an apology to Stan, to which he doesn't respond. He may be still asleep, given the time difference. Anyway, it's time to get to work. You go down to the lab and troubleshoot for a few hours, then take your habitual martini break. Looks like Stan has messaged you back.
I accept your apology, Roxy. I know you are not always in control of yourself when you are in a state. But you must realize how alarming it is to hear about clowns for someone in our situation.
You text back, sipping your glass absently.
Because of the gods. Yes, the idea that that one in particular is targeting us is, to be honest, alarming is an understatement.
He hardly ever drops off mid-sentence like that, poor Stan.
I understand. He's not exactly my cuppa either.
Speaking of cuppas, it's time to mix yourself another martini.
I'm sorry I scared you.
You scroll up to look at the picture of John again. Maybe you should show it to Rose. Wouldn't it be sweet if they could be pen pals? There's something funny about it again, though. You're not quite sure what. Isn't there something purplish on the walls? Maybe not clowns, but something similar to clowns?
You are forgiven. Are you drinking again?
Lol, hello.
Are you sure there are no clowns in your kid's room? This is really not funny anymore, Roxy.
As you take a sip and download the picture, something hazy and strange occurs to you.
Could you take another pic of the kid's wall? I need to test something.
No reply from the other end.
I mean, this is important.
I wish you would stop drinking.
I have my best ideas when I'm drinking.
As you wait for a reply, you squint your eyes at the picture. John, presents, onesie, and a certain undeniable clownishness to the walls that you were absolutely sure wasn't there before. Miraculously, Stan has sent you more pictures. Pictures of the walls, taken apparently from several angles. They all still give you a clowny feeling, one that's getting stronger with every sip of your martini. You pour yourself a straight shot of vodka, then down it in one, for science. Every wall of the room is covered in horrible purple clowns. You have to put the phone down and take a breath. What is this? You giggle. This isn't funny, but you giggle.
Clowns everywhere. Send more pics of rooms.
Roxy, in good conscience, I should ask you to lie down. It's too early in the day for this.
More pics, Danny.
I won't enable this. If you want more pictures when you sober up, I will send them.
You frown at the phone and continue texting. Why won't he help you with this? There are clowns, awful clowns, all over the walls of his kid's room. Isn't that important? You only see them when you're drunk, which maybe means Stan doesn't drink enough to see them. He will fix that. You need to send him something strong, vodka. You stagger into your room's private bar and grab the Grey Goose. Or would Stan be more of an absolute guy? Then you hear a soft noise, look up, and see him. You didn't hear anyone come in, but there's a god here in your house, in your room with you. His skin is gray. A single horn with an arrow tip arcs upward from his head. The other one is broken off, leaving a stump. He's wearing dark glasses and a midnight blue-black hood with a trailing end that drags on the ground. He's long-haired and unreasonably tall, and fuck, this guy is built. Your mouth feels like it's lagging several minutes behind your mind.
What are you doing in my...
Then you blink. You were raised in a legal seminary, and yet you don't know which god this is.
It's all right, Roxy, he says, his voice softer than you expected.
You relax instinctively, like hearing the voice of an old friend. Who is this?
I know you don't remember me, but you need to trust me when I tell you we have met before. You told me where you keep your spare key.
The god smiles almost apologetically. His teeth are perfect and sharp.
Under the flower pots beside the outer stairwell.
But your mind is whirling. Who is this? Who?
You call me Sagittarius.
The air around him shimmers, and he's now wearing a magnificent midnight blue fitted suit, emblazoned on the arms and legs with white symbols of Sagittarius, and silver cufflinks that look somewhat like the spiraling sigil for space.
Saggy, the notes, the missing spell gods, it all makes sense.
You manage.
Talk to me. When I'm like this, and I don't remember why. This is the only time you can see me. It is not an ideal situation. But if I appeared to you otherwise, the other gods would know I was here. They must not know I'm here, lest they join to war against me. I need to wait for the exact right time.
You blink, really only retaining half of it.
You don't like them.
Sagittarius nods.
I do not support the project to recreate the game, which involves you. So I must submit to my situation.
Yeah, well, join the club, bucko.
If you drink any more, you might not be able to hold your end of the conversation, but you're tempted.
You've said as much previously, yes.
Hell. You search for the nearest bottle. Grey Goose, why don't you take that out? But Sagittarius takes your hand in his. His grip is powerful, almost painful, but not quite. You're too sloshed to care. Instead, you giggle.
Holding hands now, handsome. Take me to dinner first.
He breaks out in a sweat.
You wouldn't remember it if I had.
You giggle. They are not sure if that's a joke. He takes off his sunglasses to stare into your unfocused eyes, and his gaze is as blue as the sea.
Look at me, Roxy. You must write a note to yourself. You need to tell your boss, the mage, that John Egbert is in extreme danger from the bard, and that he must move to protect the boy. You must write this to yourself exactly, with as few mistakes as possible, so you remember it later.
His grip on your hand tightens very slightly, and you feel like he's millimeters from snapping your finger bones. You feel no fear at all.
Oh, you say. Okay, then, I've got some questions.
He smiles again.
For you, I will answer all of them.
You wake up to a pounding headache, a bruised hand, Rose sleeping on the porch, a bunch of pictures of blank walls from Stanley, and a coded note stuffed into your brassiere. When you finally get around to decoding it, you're shocked to see that the note is actually meaningful this time.
Tell him drunks clowns are from Bard, protect kid.
You're not sure at first whether to believe yourself. Your drunk self is not necessarily dependable. After all, you apparently stole the spare key from under the flower pot in your last drunken spree, which was unfortunate for poor Rose, who had to wait outside until you woke up in the wee hours of the morning. Anyway, you do tell Stan about the drunk clowns being from the Bard. He seems to take it pretty seriously, and asks how to assuage the old goat's wrath.
You're not sure, but suggest that he display respect for clowns to appease the Lord of Detroit. The next time you video chat, he's got a clown painting framed on his wall, plain as sober day.
For the text of this and other stories by the same authors, visit the AO3 pages of Call Me Saltiside and Shadow_Wasserson. Suburban Jungle by Michael Guy Bowman. Special thanks to Sakiko. If you would like me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch with me using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find links to other stories that I've read, my Discord server, and various ways to support me. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.